Hey guys, this is H. John Wheelhouse. Thank you for tuning in. This podcast, we will have special guest, former WWE, WWF, Super Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion of the World, Tito Santana. That's right, Tito Santana is in the house. He's here to talk about what life was like in the ring. He's here to talk about what life is like after wrestling and what he's doing now, and he's going to discuss and promote his new book. So stay tuned. This is H-Town Wheelhouse, up next with Tito Santana.
To actually get started, Steve told me that you were a seventh grade teacher. Is that correct?
Well, it's actually seventh and eighth grade. I teach Spanish in the middle school, yeah.
Really? Okay, very cool. Well, I've been teaching seventh grade Texas history for 6 years now, and so I've been doing seventh grade Texas history, and I absolutely love I love my seventh graders. So
yeah, the seventh graders are a different animal than the eighth graders. The eighth graders, you know, we have a middle school seventh and eighth grade. The eighth graders, you know, they think they're seniors in high school. You know, it's a big difference.
Yeah, they do. They do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pause for about 10 seconds, and then we're going to get started. I was going to ask you, would you mind talking a little bit about your, I guess, your past as an American professional wrestler a little bit?
Just ask me whatever you want to ask me.
Okay. All right, man. I just want to make sure, you know, I want to be respectful. I know some people, they want to talk about the past. They want to really focus on what they're doing now. So I'll just kind of dive on in.
Let's just do a mixture.
Sounds good. All right. Well, cool deal. All right. Let me pause, and then I'll do my little intro and we'll get started. Hey guys, thanks for tuning into H-Town Wheelhouse. This is H-Town Wheelhouse, and I am joined by a special guest. I'm joined by former American professional wrestler Tito Santana. Y'all may remember him from his days on the big screen with the WWE, fighting for titles, just everything that he was growing up. The man of muscle. He had the great hair and everything. But now he's actually found his way out of the ring and into the classroom, and he teaches seventh and eighth grade Spanish. And so, Mr. Santana, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to talk to my wrestling fans in Texas. I'm originally from Texas, so when you're from Texas, you know, it's nothing like Texas.
No, yeah, you know, exactly. I've been here now. I wasn't born here. I was actually born in Florida. I came to Texas with my parents, didn't have a choice, but man, I'm so glad we moved here when I was 17 months old. And so typically what my podcast is we focus on like Astros baseball, and it's baseball, but I've been trying to spread my wings a little bit. And we happened to meet through a mutual friend, and he connected me with you. And so I figured maybe we could talk a little bit of wrestling and talk a little bit about what life is like in the classroom. Maybe you have some of the same type of wrestling matches, but mentally with the kids, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about, let's open it up and just go for it.
Definitely. So I have a question. What was the thing that drove you to get into wrestling as a professional? Is that something that you grew up around? Was it a family thing? Was it just something one day you were like, I want to be a wrestler? How did you get into it?
Well, I was not a wrestling fan. I'm from Mission, Texas.
Yes.
Down in the valley, and wrestling really came on pretty late. Wrestling from San Antonio, Joe Blanchard and Tully Blanchard, and I wasn't a wrestling fan. I was a football player. I was playing football at West Texas State University, I got a football scholarship, and I don't know if you're familiar with Terry Funk and Dory Funk.
Yeah.
You know, they're great professional wrestlers, and they went to West Texas State, and Tully Blanchard was a quarterback, and the Million Dollar Man was an offensive tackle, and, you know, there's been a lot of wrestlers that have come out of West Texas State, Bruiser Brody, Bobby Duncombe, Stan Hansen, Blackjack Mulligan, Dusty Rhodes,
wow.
Manny Fernandez, and I've probably forgotten a few. I my love was football, and, you know, I started getting letters from the NFL when I was a junior. So Tully Blanchard told me that his father thought that I could have a great wrestling career, and, you know, I really wasn't interested because I wasn't a fan. So I said, no, I want to play football. You know, I'm not interested in wrestling. Well, I went to Kansas City. I signed as a free agent with Kansas City. I lasted 10 weeks, and then I got cut, and I went to Canada to finish the season in Canada. The BC Lions picked me up, and I told Tully Blanchard, you know, I said, I want to play one more year, because I had already signed another year contract with the BC Lions. I said, and then I want to start, you know, training to become a professional wrestler, because I didn't know anything about wrestling. But Joe Blanchard starts talking to me about, you know, Merced, you could be making $80,000 a year in professional wrestling. Well, I signed with the Chiefs in 1975 for $18,000 a year.
Wow.
So I started thinking $18,000, $80,000, you know, that $80,000 started sounding pretty good. So, you know, that's what drove me into, you know, becoming a professional wrestler. And, you know, I wanted to make some money to help my family, you know, so
right.
I just saw a better opportunity in wrestling.
No, that's awesome. So, I'm familiar with Mission, Texas. Now, I don't know where Mission, Texas is in relation to Hebronville, but we have a lease down in Hebronville in Zapata County. Is that near Mission?
I think Zapata is a little bit further. I believe it's a little bit further west.
From
Mission. You know, about, I think it's like maybe 70, 80 miles, I would say.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I didn't know like how close or, you know, how far it was. I've actually only been down there once, but yeah, I've got a lot of friends from the Valley. My first when I got into ministry, because see, I was a youth pastor for 17 years, and I've been teaching this is my 11th year teaching. My very first church was in Premont, Texas, which isn't as far as the Valley. But if you go down to Premont around Falfurrias and, you know, Kingsville, and you start getting closer to, you know, the Valley and stuff, I've met a lot of people from those areas. It seems to be a lot of hardworking people. I remember Mission, Texas, from what I remember, was pretty famous for producing some pretty decent quarterbacks, if I can recall, from their high school.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they Mission was pretty good. The Detmers, you know, Sonny Detmer,
yes,
was a great coach, and both his, you know, both of his boys, you know, played there, and, you know, they both played for Philadelphia. As a matter of fact, I went to see him with their father here when I was wrestling, and, you know, they brought me in.
Oh, that's really cool.
And, yeah, it's you know, Mission is a good football town.
So did your background in football prepare you for wrestling once you got into it, or was
no.
It,
no, I,
different.
When I, the only thing that it prepared me for is the fact that I was an athlete, you know, and you know, because when I first started training, I got trained in Tampa, Florida by a Japanese wrestler. Back then, they tried to run you off, and they, you know, the first few practices, they'd work your ass off and, you know, try to wear you out and hoping that you wouldn't come back. So, you know, I kept coming back, and eventually after a while they figured out, oh, this guy really wants it, and, you know, that's how we used to earn our stripes back then. You know, nowadays, you know, it's a lot easier to become a professional wrestler, but, you know, it's not that easy to, you know, to get to the WWE.
No, yeah. So, yeah, so I was looking, you had mentioned his name was Hiro Masuda. Okay, Bob Orton, is he any relation to Randy Orton, or do they just have the same name?
No, Randy Orton is Bob Orton's son.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And Bob Orton's father, his grandfather's name was also named Bob Orton.
Okay.
And Bob Orton had a brother who is his uncle that was also breaking in at the same time. So both the father and the son were in there training Barry Orton, and, you know, they kind of helped me out too. And then Hiro Matsuda was training both of us. So, you know,
it was
a combination of people helping us out.
Yeah, that, you know, when I look at your career and the different, I guess, levels you rose up through, you like worked for Championship Wrestling from Florida. Then later that year, you joined the Georgia Championship Wrestling. And then from like 79 to 80, so you were with the WWF, and then you left the WWF, and then you returned. When you returned, I believe that was you were the Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion from 82 to 87. So you had a 5-year reign.
Yeah, I mean, I had a great career. You know,
that's amazing.
I held the tag team champions.
Yes.
The titles with the Ivan Putski, who lives in Austin, then I was a tag team champion with Rick Martel. So I had a great career in the WWF. You know, I wish we would have been making the kind of money that I'm making now. But
oh man, I know, right?
But it was still pretty good for the time. You know, we were making more money than anybody had ever made, you know, in the past. So I was in a good time. You know, not now. You know, like in every sport, you know, the money's just going crazy.
Oh yeah, I know. It's A real good friend of my dad's, the guy who's actually got us on that lease, a guy named Paul Otis, he's from Houston. He played, he was like all Southwest Conference with the U of H Cougars, and he got drafted by the Steelers. Well, kind of the same thing. He got drafted a few years before you did. I think he's got several years on you, and he was like, I could either go into the league and make less than $20,000, or I could go start a business and provide for my family. And so, yeah, I mean, the money's definitely changed. When you were kind of rising to the top, were there ever points in your wrestling career where you were kind of getting burnout or tired of it, with just your body going through all the various trials and tribulations? Or were you always driven because, like you said, you wanted to, you know, you wanted to provide for your family. You saw the rewards. What was that trek like for you?
No, I was driven. Like I said, I was an athlete, and I used to look around and I used to say, man, there's some guys that don't have anywhere near the athletic ability that I have that have been around for a long time. You know, the wrestler's career was a lot longer than the football player's career. So I was driven. Just like anything else, you know, we dealt with promoters who, you know, who would BS you and lie to you and, you know, make you promises to get you there, and then they wouldn't do nothing. And that happened to me several times. And I went to Georgia and I wrestled for a guy by the name the promoter. The booker was Ole Anderson.
Okay.
I'm sure you heard of him. And you know, I always say he's the only guy in professional wrestling that I don't have one good thing to say about.
Wow.
You know, he lied to me. He stabbed me in the back. He would call me, you know, he was racist, you know, make racist remarks. And, you know, he was the boss. And, you know, you have to eat it, you know, because he was the boss. You know, he was a bit of a bully because he was in charge.
Right.
So I ate it up. And. And then another time I went back, I played football at West Texas State, and Dick Murdoch had become the owner of Amarillo Championship Wrestling. And he was also made me all kinds of promises. And, you know, he lied to me and nothing happened. And Andre the Giant helped me get to New York. You know, Andre came in to wrestle in Amarillo, and I'd become friends with Andre. And I told him how miserable I was and how they were taking care of, how they weren't, you know, they lied to me and I was miserable. And, you know, unbeknown to me, he took a tape. One of the guys that was running the show, you know, was from New York, and he took a tape and showed it to Vince McMahon. And before you know it, I was on my way to New York. And, you know,
oh, wow.
Just like anything else, you know, you need people to help you to climb the ranks of anything, whether it's business or
right.
even in education. You know that education now is so political.
Yes,
I mean, God, it's horrible.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, I mean, I don't know, maybe you wouldn't do this, but I'm thinking if I'm Tito Santana, my interview, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm Tito Santana, right? But, you know, it is really who you know. And, you know, it's interesting because when you really look into things, like recently I interviewed Josh Rojas, who plays for the Arizona Diamondbacks. And he was talking to us because he was in this big trade the Astros had when they got Zach Greinke last year. And I was asking him what it was like the day he got traded when he, you know, and so it's really neat to hear the inner workings because as a fan or as a consumer of the entertainment product, whether it's wrestling or sports or baseball or football, you don't really get to see the behind the scenes or hear like what happened. And what it sounds like to me is just like any other major sport in wrestling, you've got to basically fight your way to the top. You've got to earn your way, earn your respect. And when you do network with the right people, that, man, all you need is that one shot, kind of like those baseball players or football players. Just give me that one shot, and I'll prove to you.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, that's what happened to me. You know, I came to the WWF, and, you know, Vince McMahon Sr., you know, took a liking at my style and, you know, my work ethic. And, you know, before you know it, you know, I was very young in the business. I had been in the business less than 3 years when I was a WWF Tech Team Champion with Ivan Putski. So that happened pretty fast, you know, for me to come from not knowing anything about wrestling to being the World Tech Team Title Champion in the WWF, which at the time was the biggest federation around.
Right.
I mean, we were wrestling in Madison Square Garden in front of 24,000 people, you know, in 79 when I came here. And you know, they had a lot of, you know, the population is here in the East Coast.
Right.
Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Staten Island, you know, they had big $20,000 people arenas, you know, that, and they used to pack them in. And, you know, it wasn't like the South. If you'd wrestle in a $6,000 arena, that was, you know, that was a big arena, you know. So the East Coast, because of the population, was able to draw a lot bigger crowds.
Now that's awesome. So I have a question. I'm sitting here thinking of you as a football player, as an athlete, and you as an athlete, as a wrestler. Is there any comparison to what it was like after a really, really tough game in football and like recovery wise for your body? Is there any comparison between that and wrestling, or were those two different types of pain waking up maybe the next day? You know what I'm saying? Was wrestling even tougher to kind of recuperate from because of all the slamming and the size of the bodies and things like that?
Yeah. You know, the football, you play once a week.
Right.
And then, you know, like, we play a game, and the next day we just go do a little jogging and you know, get in the hot tub or ice tub and, you know, let your muscles, you know, regroup and, you know, get rid of the pain, because there was a lot of pain involved also. You know, and then they would take it easy a couple of days, and you work out. Back then we'd work out pretty hard for 2 days, and then you take it easy for a couple of days, and then you'd have a game. Well, in professional wrestling, we had no pads, and it was a game on every night. You know, we used to wrestle 350 days a year, so we were always in pain. there was always something hurting. And if you were hurt and you didn't wrestle, you didn't get paid. So, you know, we just sucked it up and you know, got in the ring and, you know, we took care of each other, of course. But, you know, if you were getting bumped around, you know, about an hour after the match was over, you know, you were feeling it, you know.
Exactly. I can imagine.
And you would, we'd go like 14, 15 days. And maybe come home for, you know, one day and then go back out. Or maybe come home only because I was wrestling in New York and I was able to make it home. But, you know, maybe not have a day off. Like I said, we wrestled 350 days a year.
Wow.
And, you know, our bodies were just, you know, you know, and that's what, you know, that's what happened to a lot of the guys. That, you know, it was very easy for us to get pain pills from the doctors.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys got hooked on, you know, different medications and, you know, ended up going from one thing to another. And,
right.
You know, to me, I thought that was the culprit for a lot of guys getting involved with drugs.
Yeah. You know, when you watch a lot of those exposés, I know, I didn't take the opportunity when he was here, but there's a local autograph guy named Ryan Fitterman, and he brought in Hulk Hogan just recently, and a friend of mine went to the signing, met him and stuff, and he said, man, you can tell, like, just watching him walk, that guy has been beat up. And I watched, I think ESPN did a little special on him just talking about all the bones and the bruises and the pain and the surgeries. And you know, he said, you know, you sacrifice a lot, but he said, if it's what you do, it's just like anybody else at their job. You've got to do what you got to do to get the job done. Or like you said, you don't get paid. I see here that you were the first Mexican-American wrestler to win the Intercontinental Heavyweight Championship. For you, was that something that when that happened, like, did you like focus on that? Did you realize like, hey, I'm the first Mexican-American to win this? Like, was there just like a sense of pride within you for that? Or is it just pride overall just because, you know, man, I made it to the apex of my profession?
You know, I never thought of me being the first Mexican-American or Mexican, you know, to win the, I didn't realize it. I know that the Intercontinental title when I won it was pretty special. It was big, you know. Don Morocco and Jimmy Superfly Snuka were selling out, you know, places all over the place. I didn't realize how important, you know, me. I was married and I had young kids and I wanted to be a role model for all kids. You know,
right.
I didn't care what color they were. I took pride of. I used to always say my kids are never going to see a headline where Tito Santana gets busted with cocaine or marijuana.
Right.
Or, you know, I wanted to be a good role model. You know, my eighth grade coach was a big influence in my life, and, you know, I could have gone the wrong way. But, you know, I felt like what he did for me, you know, I wanted to be a good role model for other people. When I got inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2004,
yes, sir.
God, what's his name? God, he was a champion. Eddie, the Mexican guy, Eddie Guerrero.
Yes, okay. Eddie Guerrero.
Eddie Guerrero was a world champion at the time when I got inducted into the Hall of Fame. And he came up to me and he says, Tito, I want to thank you for opening up the doors for all the Hispanics and for me especially.
Wow.
And that was a time where it really sank in, and I said, man, you know, I guess I did something good for my people.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's, you know, and that's the thing. I think today, you know, just gosh, if you get into just like the topics of politics and race and everything, everybody, I think is so hyper-focused on it that, you know, now it's like, you know, I see that and I'm like, oh, that's really cool. But I like your message, and I can really hear your heart in that. You know, you just wanted to be a role model for everybody, and that's how I think it should be for all athletes. Yes, those guys that come up behind you, those kids that come up behind you, they're going to use that as an inspiration. And that's really cool. I'm sure it helped you stay grounded to have your family, because I can imagine being on the road, being away from your family, that the temptations were many and they were easy to fall into. If you chose.
Yeah, it was very easy. And my parents were divorced, and I saw my mom. I was a sophomore in college when they split up. And I mean, I saw my mom just doing the best that she could, trying to hang on to my dad. And, it didn't work. He left her for another woman. And, it was really hard on me, even though I was a sophomore and I was the youngest in my family. So I never forgot the pain, and I said, my kids are never going to experience that. I've been married for 38 years, and
wow,
I have three boys.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
No, that's awesome. Okay, so you had this Hall of Fame wrestling career. Now you are in the classroom, you don't go by Tito Santana. You go by your name, Merced Solis, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So what got you into thinking about teaching? Were you are you a coach also, or are you just
in
the classroom?
Like I said, it was my eighth grade football coach.
Okay.
That he started talking to me. We were migrant workers, and
okay,
I didn't get to school. We would miss like the first 6 weeks of school, so I didn't get to school until October. And, they had a real good team. I was an eighth grader, and coach tried to get me to go out for football. And I say to myself, man, those guys are big. They what the hell they'll beat me up. And I thought we had to pay for, we had to work in the fields. I thought we had to pay for the uniforms. I had no idea. So I said, my mom's not going to go, for it, spend money for me to play football and have to buy a uniform, a very expensive uniform. So I didn't even bother to ask the coach, but they had basketball tryouts, after football season, and they were undefeated, I said, man, he thinks that I can play in this team and they're undefeated. So I tried out for basketball. Me and this other kid, they used to keep us because we were migrant workers. We used to say after school, study hall with nobody around to help us. We were just getting punished. That's the way I felt.
Right.
We'd stay there and just to put some time in to say that they were, they were educating us, but there was nobody to help us.
Right.
So the other guy tells me, there's basketball tryouts. We should go try out. And he says, if we make it, we can get out of this crap. So
right.
we tried out. And, I made the team, and the poor guy didn't make the team. He had to go back to study hall by himself. I ended up being one of the best players of the team. We were undefeated. We won 33 games that year.
Oh, wow.
In eighth grade. And then the following year, my brother was going to start playing. And that was the first time that we came back to school on time. So my older brother could start the football season. So we left Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We had been working on picking cherries, and him and I took a bus. It took us like three nights, to get from Milwaukee to McAllen, Texas. And my brother went to try. He was gonna be on the team already. So first day of practice, I was kind of shy. So I went along, hoping that somebody would see me. And sure enough, this coach was walking around with, he would help the high school because he was a good athlete. And he was walking with the freshman coach, and he told the coach, I was itching for somebody to ask me. So he introduced me to the freshman coach, and he says, if you can talk this guy into going out for football, he's going to be, he could be a good one. So the coach asked me, do you want to play, son? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, show up in the morning. And I showed up in the morning. I didn't even know how to put the pads on my pants. But, I ended up having a great freshman season. I was the only sophomore that made the varsity. We were ranked fourth in the nation. You know, my sophomore year, we had a great team. And, you know, one thing led to another. I got a football scholarship, and, you know, one thing led to another, and, you know, good things have happened to me.
That's awesome. You know, it's funny. So I could sit here and tell you my whole football career is eighth grade, and I remember going out. I was the last guy you would think that would go out for the football team, but my father grew up in Florida. He's only 5'8" and a half like I am, but he played on the state championship football team in 67 with the Melbourne Bulldogs. And this, you know, my dad was my hero growing up. He would wake up in the morning, he would run with his surfboard for a mile to the beach, surf, go back to school, have track practice in the morning, and play football in the afternoon. And so when I heard those stories growing up, I was like, I'm going to play football. And I can tell you, my first football practice, I remember I was the last one out because I couldn't put my pads on. And then what happened was I actually, during tackling drills, I remember tackling a guy. I form tackled him the way coach told me to. And I think the guy carried me like 15 yards and my feet were draggy on the ground. I was throwing my guts up the first week of practice. But I do tell my students that as a running back, I retired with a five yards per carry average. I had 2 carries for 10 yards. And so I figured I would retire at the top of my game. Uh-huh. And, you know, hey, I rushed more yards per carry than Eddie George did. So there you go. I'm a legend in my own mind.
Yeah.
But so tell me, you know, I know Steve said that you teach and that you've also written a book just recently. Tell us about your book.
Yes. The title of the book is Don't Call Me Chico.
Ah, okay.
And I don't know if you remember Jesse the Body Ventura.
Yes, I do.
He used to always call me Chico when he was doing the commentating. And I didn't realize that because I didn't watch I didn't watch the matches. We were always on the road, and I didn't hear because they would do the play-by-plays, you know, in studio. Everything was taped. And I started getting to the arenas, and the fans were calling me Chico, and I thought they were insulting me, but, you know, it was catching on because Jesse was calling me Chico. And
okay.
It was starting to bother me, and one day, you know, I was laying down one Saturday or Sunday, and our show came on, whatever hotel I was in, and I heard Jesse, the body, calling me Chico, and I said, so that's where Chico comes from. And Kenny Casanova, the guy that wrote the book, is the one that came up with the title, and I said, yeah, I like it. It's a very catchy name, and, you know, the book is out. I've got some great reviews from the fans, and it's
awesome.
It's going well, and they can order it. All they have to do is go to TitoSantana.com, and you'll be able to order my book. And you know, it's almost 400 pages. And, you know, I talk about me being a migrant worker, getting started in sports, and the people that helped me. You know, I believe it's, you know, the good Lord. I'm pretty religious, you know. I like to go to church. There's no halo over my head. I'm a human being, you know, but I believe in God, and I pray all the time, and I believe that God put angels in my life throughout my life. You know, it seemed like looking back, every good move that I made, you know, somebody was placed there in my life, and you know, there's no doubt from where I came from, migrant workers, to being as successful as I have been. I owe it all to the good Lord. And so I talk about, you know, me growing up. And I used to help my uncle deliver papers just so that I could go to church with him, because my parents didn't go to church. So I just wanted to catch a ride to go to church. So, you know, I believe, you know, I'm a very strong believer. And, you know, then I talk about how I got into sports, you know, through that coach that I talked about, and I ended up getting a scholarship, and, you know, I talk about dealings that I had with promoters in professional wrestling, and not all of them good. And, you know, and then I talk about road life, you know, and the ribs that went on in the road, you know, around the business, and the backstabbing, wow, and the drugs. Wow. And, you know, I talk pretty much about everything.
That's amazing. So I saw that you had mentioned, you had mentioned Andre the Giant, you had mentioned Million Dollar Man. I was looking in there, something about a match like you were with Coco Beware. Did you ever wrestle against Hulk Hogan?
Yeah. Me and Hulk started both in 1979.
Okay.
And you know, in Florida. And then when I first came to New York, Hogan came to New York, and both of us were still pretty green. You know, this is a hard business to learn.
I can imagine.
We it didn't happen overnight. You know, we both, you know, took our licks, and we both got help from a lot of guys. And I wrestled him twice, you know. And
wow.
I won one, and I got my arm raised once, and he won one. And I was a very lucky man, because Hogan got big pretty fast. We were in New York for a year. Then we went to Japan together. Then we went to Minnesota. But in between Japan and Minnesota, Sylvester Stallone sent four letters to four different wrestlers about what was it, Thunderlips or
yeah,
you know,
Thunderlips.
The
from
wrestling
Rocky
show.
Three.
Yeah,
Rocky Three.
And Hogan was the only one that answered the letter, you know.
Really?
And the other guys didn't answer, so that's how Hogan got that part. And
interesting.
You know, Hogan, you know, then they brought him into Minnesota, and they were going to make him a bad guy. But he looked so good, and then the way the promoter promoted his Rocky movie, you know, you couldn't turn him heel. People kept cheering for him.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
And then he got over like $1 million, and so I was with in the same territory that Hulk was 90% of my career.
Wow.
So I made a lot of money, because, you know, he was, you know, selling out big crowds, you know, all the time.
Oh yeah. Well, let me tell you, I was a little Hulkamaniac myself, and, you know, I was all about eating my vitamins, brother, and, you know, do my little eat your vitamins, brother, you know, and doing my Hulk Hogan impressions. And so one of these days, I'm gonna get to meet him. He's definitely a celebrity athlete bucket list of mine that I would like to connect with, or, you know, meet someday. But, you know, all you guys, I just, you know, I remember growing up, and I remember really enjoying wrestling, and I would never ask you to, like, necessarily compare or you know, I know there's probably a certain code within the wrestling community, but it just seems today like wrestling's changed a lot. There's a lot more drama and out of ring, like kind of like soap opera type of feel for me, that I haven't really been able to get into wrestling as much lately. It's just, it's not what I remember growing up. You know, I remember WWE, I remember WCW, WWF, all that stuff. I grew up big fans, and I remember getting to see Andre the Giant fight against Hulk Hogan at the Sam Houston Coliseum in Houston, Texas. Did you ever fight in the Sam Houston Coliseum?
Yes, I did.
Man, I love that place.
Yeah.
I miss that place. I really wish they would never turn that thing down. I loved it, man. That was, I can't tell you how many wrestling matches we watched there. That was so cool.
Well, you know, if you just think about it, when we were doing it, we're called the legends. You know, back then, before this new era, now it's a TV show. Back then, it was a wrestling show.
Mm.
Most of the fans believe that wrestling was on the up and up. And the reason they believed is because we only made money on the crowds that we drew.
Wow.
So in order to draw the crowds, we had to be pretty convinced the fans that what we were doing was real. You know, it was pretty close to real. Now, you know, everybody is smart, you know, and they know that it's totally entertainment, and they just go in there and they beat the crap out of each other for no rhyme or reason, and people just don't buy it. You know, they just can't get the same enthusiasm that they had in the past.
Right, and see, the only wrestling league that I've watched recently that I think comes close to what I saw growing up is this AEW that came out.
Right.
It's All Elite Wrestling. I mean, now, and not just that, but they kind of brought a whole new element to wrestling. They're like way more acrobatic. I mean, the stuff they're doing, I'm like, oh my gosh, you look like a stuntman in a Hollywood movie. Like, the moves they are doing are just insane, as to where I remember, because I told my son, we're having this discussion, I said, you know, when I watch wrestling, like, I remember, like, sometimes there was blood, like, I'm like, there was real, like, these guys are really getting hurt. There was one guy on one wrestling match, and he was kind of punching or whatever, and my son goes, he's not really punching him. And I said, well, hey, let's watch some old wrestling matches. Let's watch some of Dad's wrestling matches. He's like, man, those guys are really getting hurt.
people believed that back then, because we had to convince the fans, you know, that what we were doing was real, so they could come back to there was better soap operas, you know, there was rematches, there was reason for rematches.
Now, when you were in the apex of your career, you could go places. You were Tito Santana. Were like wrestling fans, were some people like apprehensive to approach you? Like, did they treat you differently? Cause they're like, oh man, he's a professional wrestler. Like, I don't want to mess with him. You know what I'm saying? Was there anything like that? Or was that maybe just attributed to maybe more of the wrestlers that were dubbed as the villains in the league? You know what I'm saying?
No, you know, the professional wrestler, we were more recognizable than any other athlete, for the simple reason that we were on TV so often, and they
right.
could see our they could see our faces.
Okay.
Like, you know, a football player, they're underneath the helmet.
Exactly.
A baseball right. player wears a hat. And we were on, you know, year round, you know, three or four times a week. So the wrestling fan, they feel like they're your buddies. You know,
right.
when they see you, they just want to talk to you, and they come up and they
cool.
want your autograph. You know, and it was a little tough, you know, at times, because like you'd be in the middle of putting food in your mouth in a restaurant, and they'd want you to sign something, you know, and, you know, that was about the only time that I wouldn't sign. I would tell the fan, look, please let me finish eating. As soon as I get done eating, I'll sign whatever you have for me. But, you know, please let me finish eating.
Right.
And a lot of times, you know, they were not upset. A lot of times they'd get pissed off, you know, because you wouldn't sign something for them.
Yeah, you know? No, yeah. And that, you know, for me, that's always been one of my things. And, I mean, gosh, I'm 44 now, and, you know, I remember the first time I got Jose Altuve's autograph several years ago. I was, what, like 40, and I was like a kid in a candy store. You know, I try not to slide into my junior high self, and maybe that's why junior high works well for me, because I kind of still have that kind of mindset. But I've always thought, and as I've gotten older, I appreciate when athletes are okay to tell fans, hey, you know what, I'm not going to sign that right now. As opposed to, you know, if they're kind of out and about or whatever, if they're with family, we've seen a couple of Astros in the area, and my son will be like, I don't want to bother him. I'm like, okay, that's cool. We won't. And, you know, and so he asked me, he's like, I wonder if they get upset at that. I'm like, well, I'm sure it gets old after a while. So I was going to tell you, one of my friend's nephew saw The Rock at Disney World one time when he was wrestling. And I guess he was kind of in disguise. Like, you couldn't really recognize him. I think he was wearing a hat and some sunglasses. And this little kid went up to him. And he looked at The Rock and he goes, what's your name? And I don't know if you followed any of the more modern wrestlers, but the whole Rock's mantra was, it doesn't matter what your name is. And he asked him what his name was, and he started to say Dwayne Johnson, and the kid stomped his foot, and he goes, it doesn't matter what your name is. And they said the Rock just busted out laughing. And his my friend's brother and sister-in-law got to talk to him, and he said, you would be shocked how many people are afraid to even walk up to me because they think I'm this like really mean person. I think The Rock kind of played a little bit of a bad guy through like most of his character role.
Right.
But he just said, this little kid had the guts to approach me, and I was floored. He's like, he signed stuff for him. So I'm sure that was cool. Now, I mean, even today, do you do autograph shows? Do you do appearances?
Yeah. You heard about the Rock's father passing away, right?
You know what? I did not.
Yeah. His father was Rocky Johnson.
Okay.
And he passed away last night.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he just died of a heart attack.
Oh, man, that is yeah, I didn't, I mean.
As a matter of fact, I did an appearance Saturday in somewhere in New Jersey, and he was supposed to be there, and he didn't make the flight because I heard he was in the hospital, and then he came home, and then he had a heart attack.
Oh, man, I hate to hear that. Yeah,
it was definitely a shock to everybody.
Yeah, man, we definitely send our condolences because I mean, he was very instrumental in pretty much everything that Rock did. I mean, that's what really, it was basically like kind of like a family thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I met The Rock when he was like 9 years old. He would come to the matches.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, man, I'm sorry to hear about that loss. That's never easy to take.
Yeah.
So this book, Don't Call Me Chico, I actually just looked it up, and I think I'm definitely going to have to order one, and I think I'm going to order a signed copy one from your site. What I'll do is I will order a signed one, and then when I get it, I'll show people on my page. I run a Facebook page called Strohs 411, and we have about 31,000 followers.
Uh-huh.
You know, once I get once I get this interview posted, I'll share this interview with my fans and hopefully widen my audience a little bit. Mr. Santana, this has been a great interview, and
you can friend me on Facebook. I'm under Michelle Solis.
Okay, I will
do
that.
If you send me a message so I know, because I can't tell you how many people want to be my friends, you know. And
okay.
If they have like 5 followers, you know,
I hear you. I hear you.
You know,
no,
but
yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. So you know, yeah. Send me a little message, and you know, and remind me, and I'll accept your invitation, and you know, it'll also help me expand it when I ask to share, you know, things, you know, on Facebook.
No, yeah, definitely. And you know what we could also do on Facebook is we can actually connect with a video podcast where we can go like Facebook Live, and you could be on video and I could be on video, and we could even have people on there. You could promote your book. We could
I don't know how to do stuff like that.
Well, you know what? When we're done with this conversation, what I'll do is I'll send you a message in Facebook, and maybe one day you and I can talk on the phone. You can actually do it through your cell phone very easily. So I can help you with all that, sir.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
It was great.
I think we've been here close to an hour, but it flew.
No, it's good. No, it went by. It was fluid. I mean, to be talking to one of the legends I grew up loving is actually just a big time honor for me. So I appreciate your time, Mr. Merced. God bless you. God bless your family, and God bless your kids. Hopefully, you have a good Friday tomorrow. Hopefully, the kids aren't too crazy.
Yeah, it's this time of the year they start turning on you.
They do. They do. Well, yeah. Hey, man, you be strong and just make sure you don't do any suplexes or chokeholds.
Well, thank you so much, and arriba.
Yeah. All right. I love it, man. All right. Thank you, Mr. Santana. You have a great one. This is H-Town Wheelhouse. It is an Astros podcast, but we had a special detour into WWF territory with former Intercontinental Heavyweight Champion Tito Santana. Thank you so much, and hopefully we can connect in the near future.